I came in 1966.
You came from a university?
Yeah, from Yale. Mm-hmm. I was on the faculty there.
And what sections did you come up through at the board?
I started in the banking section.
When did you become involved in FOMC, preparation of FOMC materials?
Well, early on, I went from banking section and was head of this, what was called special studies section, and then was put ahead of all of the model work and econometric work that was being done. And at that time, I started going to FOMC meetings. I think I started going to FOMC meetings in 68, something like that, when Martin was still chairman. I started doing active participation a year or two later, I think.
So did you start in, do you remember when in 1968 you started, summer 68? Or?
Boy, I just can't remember. Mm-hmm. Been too many years.
I don't want to get too far off track, but I can't help asking you these things. There was a very important call in summer 1968 after the passage of the income tax surcharge when the Green Book had been predicting real growth in the range of 6% or so, and with the passage of the surcharge, it predicted that real growth would drop to zero, and partly on that basis, although there were other reasons involved too, Chairman Martin lowered the funds rate. Were you involved at all in that forecast?
I was aware of the forecast. All I can remember is being very critical of it. And that's all I can really remember. That was before, later on, I was responsible for a lot of the forecasts and made them, and then I'll tell you if I screwed up. But all I can remember then was that that forecast made very little sense to me. But that was before. You have to remember, back in 68, analytic economics was just barely beginning to have an effect on the staff and on monetary policy. So I don't find, it wasn't at all surprising that they would make a forecast like that, that people didn't know how to make a difference between transitory and permanent changes, and really weren't very interested in hearing such things.
Did you have much contact with Dan Brill?
Yeah.
He ultimately left over that forecast.
Right.
I understand.
Well, among other things, that's right. I was a great fan of Dan Brill. I think he was very good, very nice, hard-headed man, but sort of was not super well-trained in economics. And I think he didn't have a staff to do it. That was one of the reasons I was brought in. I was brought in, the hotshot from Yale, to try to change that.
When did Jerry Ensler come in?
Jerry was there about the same time. I can't really remember when he was hired. Sometime in the mid-60s, late 60s. I can't remember anymore.
Mm-hmm. Peter Tinsley, he came in?
Same.
Mm-hmm. When did the...
Peter a little later, I think. But there were a number of people who were brought in.
Green Book forecast began.
Or different, huh?
Green Book forecast began in November 1965, but it was quite a bit later when there were actually model forecasts. It wasn't until early '69 that a model forecast actually got off the ground.
Well, you're going to know that better than I do. I'm pretty bad at dates. That wouldn't surprise me. The Green Book used to be completely retrospective. And then became somewhat forward-looking, but cautiously so. And the models, you always have argument as to the role that the models had in the Green Book forecasts, I presume, up to today. I don't see Green Books anymore, so I have no idea, but at least when I was there, there was only one forecast. There was not a model forecast versus judgmental. This was the staff's forecast. Then in FOMC meetings or in briefings, the question would come up about the degree to which the forecasts would differ. But there weren't two different forecasts.
But at some point in the 1970s, I came here in 1975. It seems to me at that point we were getting two forecasts. We were getting a separate model forecast, and we were also getting a green book.
Well, I think that was after I left. That doesn't surprise me. I mean, because it got to the point where every time the question was asked.
Mm-hmm.
And let me go back a step. The model was first being used. The idea was a tool. It was a tool to help us forecast. And there was an interaction among between the model forecasters and the judgmental people. And in the process of these meetings, we would often each change our forecast as we listened to the other. Because the model was always subject to constant term adjustments. There was no way to run that thing without some kind of adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a great deal of judgment always in it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it always seemed to me inappropriate, given the way that it was used, to talk about the model versus the other. Because they really, you know, what the model was primarily being used for back in those days was to force to force constraints and to force adding up conditions and things like that, that judgmental forecasters are very bad at, and to try to get at some of the dynamics, but not the short-term forecasting.
Mm-hmm.
So the model was always adjusted because we watched each other. The judgmental people were much better at short-term than a model was, because models do averages. It was very hard for them to make all these near-term things, so we'd adjusted for that. Later on, there was a demand to see what the model by itself gave. And I was never clear whether that was to make to embarrass the model or what.
Mm-hmm.
And was by those who didn't want to use this or didn't like the results of it. But there never could be a pure model one, because you had to make adjustments every time it was used. And anybody who said that wasn't true was just not telling you the correct story. Otherwise, it'll wander off into nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Would you be willing to tell me the history of the subcommittee on the directive? I came in 1975, so this was almost over by the time I got there. There was who was the governor interested in that, and how did that get off the
ground? All I can remember was Frank Morris was on it, I believe. God, I don't remember anymore.
Governor Holland and maybe...
Well, Bob was. He would be involved for sure.
Bruce McClory.
That doesn't surprise me. Wasn't Morris on it? I can't even remember. I remember endless meetings over this. This is all I can remember at this point. If you sort of help my memory along, like jog my memory, I'll be able to do better.
Well, I know some of the staff members who were involved. Kalchbrenner, that's
the right. Jack did it, right?
And Tinsley, I've not talked
to right,
him,
right,
him yet.
And
the purpose was to try to rationalize decision making.
Well, in what sense? I mean,
to start with, again, I'm going back to what I remember when I came here shortly before the thing was discussed at an FOMC meeting. And at that point, we simply got some staff memos that were in final form. But the impression I got was that this took place at a time when combining optimal control methods with the large-scale econometric model was the cutting edge of research in macroeconomics. And the idea was to try to push the FOMC into specifying an objective function so that a model along with optimal control methods could be used to generate a path for interest rates or money stock that then would serve as kind of a benchmark for assessing FOMC behavior.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's making it much fancier than it was.
Mm-hmm.
And surely the discussion among the principals, governors and the Reserve Bank presidents, there wasn't a great deal of time spent talking about optimal control methods.
Mm-hmm.
Or the divide, or you know, it, it wasn't nearly that technical. A lot of work was going on at that time. It had for several years on optimal control. People like Tinsley and Roger Green and so on had done a lot of the work that, you know, and we were talking to control theorists from MIT and the whole bit, you know, in engineering. The trying very hard to see the insights that dynamic optimization would give you. The idea was never to come up with a number. Mm-hmm. The idea was to come up with a story. And was it possible to use models? I gave a lot of adjustment. I mean, there was people didn't use the models or really, you know, who were sort of on the periphery, really thought they worked and that you could just run them. And believe me, you never could. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of fooling around.
Yeah.
Thing wasn't stable. There was a tremendous amount of adjustment, and there was so much adjustment, anyone who used them knew that you had to take it all with a grain of salt. It was a dynamic structure, was what it was, and you're using it to do optimization games and seeing if it gave you insights. That was really what its purpose was, and that's what the directive committee was all about, was trying to see, could the directive be changed in a way to get that, in principle, it sounds so trivial, but to get the FOMC to be forward-looking. All during the late 60s and through all the 70s till I left, the big war was to get the FOMC to look beyond the end of its nose, to realize that the decisions it made today had implications a year from now. And to quit saying, I won't believe that this policy is inflationary till I see it, until the prices start rising. You know, I spent years hearing that from FOMC members. I'll believe it when I see it. And you say, well, by the time you see it, it's too late. And so we tried very hard to try to figure ways to tell this basic story. And, you know, terms like soft landing and stuff and the moon landing and all those sorts of things, the jargon that people like to hear, came into those kind of discussions and it sort of helped. All right, there was that thread. The other thread was that there was a school of people who thought that you could simply optimize monetary policy by controlling the quantity of money. And there's another school of people, most of our board staff and some others, who thought the world was more complicated than that. And in fact, in some sense, you ought to look at everything, and that you ought to then you look at all the information. The idea is how to optimally filter the information, and that's the feedback that you were talking about, how incoming information then should lead you to change your forecast and your specification of policy.
Yeah, I recollect now that Mike Caron was on the committee, so he would have represented
that. Right.
I suppose Jack Kerrigan from
Minneapolis. Jack Kerrigan and Tinsley and people like that, and I would more looking at everything in a disciplined sense. I mean, you can make it sound silly.
Yeah, I understand.
Thing looking at everything, but the point is that you don't throw away all information except one variable, and a trivial but correct point, which is if you're controlling money, it can give you no information.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to look at the things you're not controlling to give you the information.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kerrigan done a lot of work. Probably the best work ever done on this was done by Tinsley.
Mm-hmm.
In an almost totally unreadable paper, but it was really good.
Mm-hmm.
That was Peter's problem always. It's very hard for others to forget what he was up to, but it was really good. So anyway, that was sort of it was mainly to get people to be forward-looking and to try to figure out how to mold information coming from the outside in. Now, I was sort of on both sides of that. I always came across more of a monetarist than I was, simply because I was, being a monetarist back in those days, forced the FOMC to be more restricted than they otherwise would be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent most of my time trying to keep them from getting off this random walk on money, you know, where they just tried to always hit a change and they never worried about a level. And part of the thing on the directive committee, you know, I got involved was just that, which was more of a blue book thing than a green book.
Mm-hmm. So then you must have been involved in the process of where the the Blue Books began to show paths that would get you back to...
Yeah, that was my doing, right? Mm-hmm. I think those disappeared the day I left. The level of the Burns hated those. Oh, I hated those. Yeah, right.
Talk about Burns in a second.
But anyway, that's right. And so that's why I got involved again with the directive, how to get back to. And the question is, how quickly you get back to, and it clearly depends upon what's going on in the economy and things like that. But you needed the discipline of getting back to something that was a quantity.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what proposal then did the committee come up with to cause that would have had the FOMC think in terms of a strategy whereby their individual actions today had to be part of a longer run strategy that would provide inflation control? And,
you know, I think it really didn't, mm-hmm. that I can remember. I mean, that's why I can't recall anything. It was a directive committee. The members of it thought it was a lot more important than it was. I think this committee, as in classical Washington behavior, if you don't want anything done, you start a committee. So I don't think this thing ever was to, in fact, do anything. And I can't even remember the, since it had such disparate members, I can't recall even what they came up with.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't update anything.
Well, they discussed it the meeting after they stopped taking minutes.
Right, so I remember that.
Never saw, that would have been, I don't know, April.
I remember there was a discussion.
Of course, I had just come at that point, and all I remember is our director of research, Jim Parthian, saying that Burns took a couple puffs on his pipe and said, "Well, I've been doing that all my life."
Right, that's right.
And
so,
and then just dismissed it.
That's right.
And then I guess it just.
And it never was going to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of, there was mounting criticism of the way that policy was being conducted, which really had, well, part of it was technical, but a great deal of it was veiled criticism of Burns. And it took the form, well, how do I want to say this? Burns would get his way by always just forgetting the past and go forward. And so the fact that money was two standard deviations above where it was supposed to be was neither here nor there. Let's talk about the future. And so where you, initial conditions never made you ever see them.
Mm.
And so, you know, for political reasons, like he understood all this stuff. And so there's a lot of pressure to try to get the discipline of bringing things back to, you know, worrying about initial conditions and where you were and how fast to get back. Things he didn't want to hear. Because it would, from time to time, get in the way of what he wanted to accomplish. And so it's not at all surprising. Well, first of all, this committee got established as some way to put off the pressure, and then secondly, that it didn't, in fact, come to anything.
So you don't remember which commissioners in particular were involved. It makes sense that Frank Morris was involved, and I suppose, I don't know, Andrew Brimmer.
Was Andy on it for a while, I think.
He must, I know, he left, I think, fairly early on, well, I don't know, 73
right.
or so, I think my recollection is that he would cross swords with Burns.
Yeah, he would. Well, in a very genteel way, but he would.
Well, nobody really took him. I mean, nobody took him on.
No, closest was Jeff Sheehan. yeah, that's it. It was all very gentle. I can't even remember who was on that thing. Well, how long? It's because it wasn't a big deal. I mean, it was a lot of useful research that went on,
mm-hmm.
a lot of useless meetings, and there never was any prospect it was going to come to anything. So it was always very hard for me to keep my enthusiasm up with that thing.
Mm-hmm. But the general objectives that you mentioned, in particular, seeing individual policy actions as part of a strategy which acts over time, and actions having kind of a lagged effects over time, and kind of constraining yourself on the basis of a plan. I mean, that's a very general idea. There's no that's not gonna. That's a reasonable ideal, right?
Right.
But
oh, sure.
That's never going to happen because the chairman is always in a position where he gets into difficult positions at various times, and he wants flexibility to choose his policy action without being constrained and somebody pointing and saying, hey, that's not part of the strategy. That doesn't make sense.
Sure. Right. And I think that's why he was less than excited about this. I mean, all the efforts, such as having a growth path for money, right, on the level, you could talk about bringing it back. Yeah, he hated that. He took it out once and took a lot of lobbying, and it got, if there was at least one blue book where it was gone, and then there was a lot of lobbying by me, and then it got back in. He didn't like it because it would tie his hands. Sometimes there would be times that he would want to do something, and it would make it more difficult. Mm-hmm. And so this whole thrust behind the directive committee was not to try to do in Burns, but rather having this kind of discipline will always reduces the scope for doing whatever you want to do. You know, it takes away some of your flexibility. That's right.
Yeah, of course, Martin was exactly the same way. As long as the agenda is set in terms of deciding a particular policy action. Given that information always comes in somewhat contradictory ways, he could always influence that particular policy act.
I remember one meeting. Telling stories, but thoroughgoing discussion of what was going on in the economy, and back then it was by the, what we call judgmental economists and the non-analytic guys. It was a very credible story. And when we go through, Martin said, well, I don't believe it because I just talked to the president of Macy's and he told me. And it was that sort of thing. And, it just drives you crazy. Based on this sample of one, right?
Well, that means Martin wanted staff.
I think that's correct. He wanted to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, Martin associated knowledge of monetary policy with the knowledge of the bond markets.
That's right.
He thought he knew monetary policy. What he wanted around was people who could supply information to him, who could give him information, and of course, anecdotal information was as good as any.
That's all he had back then. But at least this was systematically, anecdotal. It was lots of anecdotes as opposed to a fair amount of measurement. That's right.
Yeah.
And so, I think any chairman. Maximum scope. I mean, since the chairman is so immensely more powerful than the other members of the FOMC, it's never in the chairman's interest to let anything tie his hands. I think that's right. It may be in the nation's interest, but it's not in the chairman's interest.
Obviously.
Back in Martin's time, was so non-analytical and sort of old-fashioned economics. That it was really hard to make a contrast. I mean, to make comparison with him and Burns, because by the time Burns, well, in his tenure, he was really hard-nosed and analytical, and he was finding it much more difficult to go up against some of these things. He didn't like it.
Well, but let me ask you about what you mean about Burns being analytical. I mean, Burns.
He didn't say he was in his own way. But I said that the presentations were much more analytical.
I see.
That we didn't do, there was no more tone and feel of the market.
Mm-hmm.
When I started first going to FOMC meetings, I thought that was a joke that people talked about tone and feel. They did talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the manager was sent back to New York to feel it some more. I mean, I never knew what he was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Of course, that also gave Martin flexibility to choose interest rates that he...
No, I learned that. That's right. But I didn't know it at the time. Sure.
But let me ask you about Burns, though. Here's somebody who's a head of the MBR. And so he wasn't a neoclassical economist in the sense that you and I are. Was he in that? We think, when we think of a model of the economy, we think of structural relationships that ideally are derived from optimizing behavior, intertemporal utility maximization, maximized profits, or whatever. But Burns went back to a time before that was a standard way to think about the economy. And he had in his mind an incredible number of cyclical relationships between variables. And what drove, over time, what drove the relationship between these variables was waves of optimism and pessimism. And kind of the key thing then was where you were in the cycle and what was the sense of confidence of the businessman or the consumer or whatever. So it was, I mean, we would consider that pop psychology. We wouldn't consider it. I mean, I think that, I mean, I'm saying this partly because I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a little misleading because we say, hey, economist, and for us, since everybody we know has been trained in this neoclassical post-Keynesian macroeconomic framework that, you know, we just assume we know what economist means, but he didn't think in those...
but I think, you know, even though he and I got into some dreadful wars, I think the man deserves his due, right? I'm one of the few people, I guess, who have read Burns and Mitchell.
Yeah, so have I, and that's where I'm getting a lot of this from, because it seems to me...
And that's
sense.
Really what it was, except they didn't understand second-order difference equations, so they had a terrible time getting the thing to change direction on them. But they had really a dynamic story.
Right.
Part of the dynamic story had to be with either bottlenecks developing or supply constraints, and often the banking sector would play its role because it would run out of reserves and, you know, couldn't lend and all that sort of stuff. It was sort of a verbal and much more complicated version of Hicks's trade cycle stuff, you know, with ceilings and floors and all that. And he was really, I guess, trying to model Burns and Mitchell. But they did. Well, one thing they did understand with a vengeance is that things have memories, and once they get started, they tend to go in the same direction, and that there's a dynamic structure. Right.
Mm, right.
They certainly were not static in any sense of the word. And another thing, they looked at absolutely everything. I mean, my God. I mean, I took a course when I was in graduate school. We actually had to read that book and look at all these reference cycle relatives and all of that sort of thing. It turned out many years later that a lot of the stories they told held up. That there are these basic structures of cycles and things like that that they seem to unearth with some really simple techniques. But to them, I think, it Burns particularly, things were very complicated. And he surely was not a neoclassical economist. Simon is not well known. And he came to Washington a firm believer, back to Washington, he came to the board a firm believer in incomes policies.
Why do you say he came that way? Because in the mid-60s he...
But his first time I ever met that man, he'd just been appointed. I don't know whether he had taken over, I can't remember, but I had lunch with him. And he said, well, tell me, Mr. Pierce, what do you think about incomes policies? And I said, I don't know, what's that? And so he had to tell me what it was. And I said, well, not much. And he said, why not? And I said, well, I just, fascism doesn't appeal to me.
Wow, okay.
All right? Yeah. This is when he first started. He was feeling everybody out. He was a big pusher in the Nixon administration for wage price controls. I mean, this is not Mr. Neoclassical. He's so funny. I mean, he was an extreme interventionist in every sense. He loved doing it.
Right, but the question is why. In the mid-60s, he came out with very strong statements against the wage price guideposts of the Heller and Ackley.
That's right.
Council.
Right.
And the question is, why did he change his
mind? I had a theory on that. I think it's because of the stage of the business cycle. It was management had just taken its turn. If you could keep the pressure off of wages, they'd do just fine.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he had this idea that the reason the cycle turned around was this change in prices between the price level and the wage rate, and that's what would get you out of a recession.
That's so right. He thought it really was a different instrument. Then we could get out of recession without inflation.
That is, you go into a recession, and then the natural working of the economy is for profits to increase because wages fall relative to prices. And if that doesn't happen, the businessmen don't have the confidence to go out and invest. And when he didn't see
that... Well, the profits, don't even have to be just your confidence.
When he didn't,
yeah, that's right.
When he didn't see that, the United States hadn't been through a peacetime inflation before. He hadn't seen the relationships that subsequently people got used to. So when he didn't see, he saw wages continuing to rise when economic activity and aggregate price level inflation began to fall, he thought economics wasn't working anymore.
That's right. I mean, you have to remember, in 69, that was a truly engineered recession. And Nixon was sold a bill of goods by economists. I mean, I'm no Nixon fan, but this one wasn't his fault. He was told that we had a short, sharp recession. It would wring out the inflation and everything would be cool. We had our short, sharp recession and prices went up. Mm-hmm. And that's when the story started going on about how the world had changed. Old economics didn't work, and we had to have new tools, and we had to do all that. Nobody listened to stories like, "Well, my God, there's dynamics, and if you build up enough inflationary pressures, this thing will keep going." No, it had to be the world had changed, and Burns became part of that. And so you needed other methods. You had to break the back of the wage spiral. So you put the way to do that is put the lid on wages. And that allowed monetary policy and then to pump up the economy and everybody be happy. He and I had made wars over that, I'll tell you.
Did he like to argue with people the way
economists
do?
He used to have me in to hear all this so he'd be ready for Congress. I got to be, for the longest time, that's why I got so turned off by Washington. Here I thought, Jesus, isn't this exciting? I was pretty young. I was talking to this really powerful man.
He's listening to you, yeah.
Listening to me, and my God, isn't that... He didn't give a damn. He just wanted to hear the arguments. He figured I was the best at the arguments, so I got to come in and let him practice. I'm going to change a thing.
But let me ask you that McCracken Council and later the Stein Council, they were very much impressed by the experience with money. 1968, you have a tax increase, high money growth, the economy doesn't slow down. So these people who had been Keynesians become kind of St. Louis equation people who believe they can exploit a Phillips curve trade-off. Can control the economy with money a la St. Louis equation. So you've got this group on one side and you've got Burns on the other side. In looking at this period, I get the feeling that that the administration had what Burns really wanted, which is the fiscal policy and microeconomic policy tools to get in and change microeconomic things within the economy, repeal Davis-Bacon Act, for example, wage price controls is the big example. And on the other hand, Burns had what the council wanted, which is monetary control.
Right.
So they got together and they traded. And in a way, ultimately, Burns lost out because he was willing to give up money growth because he didn't think it was that important. He thought what was important was how quickly people spent the money because that depended upon confidence. And as long as he had a handle on confidence, he believed he had a sense of how rapidly people were going to expand, then it didn't make a lot of difference what money growth was. So he and the council kind of got together and traded, and each got some of what they wanted. But
now what period? What? Do you, what?
Well, 71, 72.
I don't think that. I think you're overdoing his confidence thing. Sure, he believed in that and animal spirits and all of those sorts of things. But I think he was fully aware of the fact that he was being highly expansionary. He thought he could do it. He had two instruments, two targets, right?
Mm-hmm.
He had real output, money to do that one, and he had inflation, waste price controls took care of that one. No, I don't think that's right.
Mm-hmm. But then if you...
That was done on purpose. I mean, he, you know...
If you believe that, then
it's... Was he a monetarist in the sense that there was just one number you look at? No. But it turned out during that period you could look at any number. It didn't make a particle difference which one you looked at. They're all telling you the same thing. Monetary policy was highly expansionary.
But if
any standards.
Yeah, but if in a way my story is more favorable to him.
This is a lot of meetings and having a lot of arguments.
Yeah. But you have to, if you go back and you look at this period, you can't get around the fact that shifts in monetary policy occurred at times when the administration wanted shifts in monetary policy.
That does not, that's correct. And my answer is, well, how about that?
And
I once accused, well, not to him, but people, I said he wanted Nixon to get all the votes. That's right.
And so my story makes it, kind of gets around, well, you know, Burns was political. I don't have to say that.
He was political. He was an extremely political man. And he was also very, very smart. And I think you don't want to say, well, he was this old fuddy-duddy that just believed in expectation. That was one smart man. He knew what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
The smartest people I've met.
So he basically just misjudged the extent to which controls would suppress inflation.
I think that's
right. Absence of experience with.
Yeah, I mean, I think
controls.
He didn't really appreciate the role of how much, you know, when you build up inflationary pressures like that, how hard it is to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of funny. I mean, you would think, you know, German experience and all this. I mean, man, no economic history. He just, I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's somebody who attached.
Someone said somehow, for all his bravado and his intelligence and his presence, he was always trying to become acceptable to the White House. And I think that's probably right. It's sort of sad.
Well, he wanted to act on a grand stage, and he wanted to influence.
No, but also he was trying to. I think he was looking for approval in some sense. You know, to somehow doing good by those people. I can't prove that. That's just, and I've had several other people mention this to me as well, know him. It helps explain otherwise unexplainable things.
Well, but again, my explanation is more favorable.
No, I know.
But in the sense that this happens, I think that happened with Martin, too, who wanted to influence fiscal policy and was willing to do it.
But look
off
at the difference.
Martin
caused a credit crunch. No, you go back and it didn't look like anything now. It was then.
Mm-hmm.
He was willing to. No, I mean, that was like night and day.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he was fuzzy, was he? And he didn't know all about simultaneous equation systems, dynamic optimization, mm-hmm. but boy, did he know how to rattle cages. And he rattled a cage. Now, he got sold a bill of goods with his income surtax. But he came right back in 69. Before he left, it was going back up again. I mean, this was a guy that actually knew about inflation. There's no evidence that he was any kind of co-conspirator in this. He was rattling cages.
Mm-hmm.
Burns, on the other hand.
Of course, in 69, then the Nixon administration
and then
was
Burns took over. That's right.
Was willing to have a tight.
That was the original White House strategy.
Thought,
the idea was early in the administration to wring out the inflation.
But Martin wasn't rattling any cages in 69 because the administration. The only time he really rattled the cage was that period in the summer of 66 when actually he was in the hospital. But
that's right. But I mean, he was involved in it. And
sure, I'm sure he was.
And, you know, the bond market closed. It was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
He was willing to change the rules of the game in order to get the administration's attention. So no, I don't think it was the same. I think that you sort of want to compare those two.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you what Burns' ultimate motives are. I mean, the man was a very political animal. What he said wasn't necessarily what he was thinking. All I ever told people then and afterwards is just look what happened, not what he said, what he do.
Mm-hmm.
That's obvious what he did.
Mm-hmm. Then, why did monetary policy become restrictive in 1974? It became very restrictive. Was it because he simply wanted a restrictive policy? He'd been burned by the criticism that
the word went out to the desk that money growth was not to exceed, I think, 6%, period. And when Holmes we was in Washington every day. I mean, I'd never seen such pressure put on. I mean, it was intense.
Hmm.
He was going back and forth. Yeah. And this was to make a point.
Yeah.
And suddenly, Burns became the monitor. He didn't care about me. He just, you know, he needed a symbol. So it was tough for a while.
Our principals said that he was always saying that the problem's not enough. The problem is not a lack of money. It's a lack of oil. The implication being that he thought the recession was a consequence of the oil price shock, had nothing to do with monetary policy. Now that's what our principals thought that he was saying, but you're saying he knew policy was restrictive.
Sure.
That's what he wanted, and
that's right. Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if there's any public record of that, but I'll tell you, I might used to tease the man about it. The poor guy was in town every day on Holmes.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear. He was in town?
He was going back and forth. Burns had him into Washington every day, and he'd get back on the plane, go back to New York. I mean, the pressure on them to, you know, to keep it tight was amazing.
And who was that you mentioned? Peter Sternlight? Was he the... Who came
back? No, not then. Peter hadn't taken over yet.
So
who was Holmes, I think.
Alan Holmes, okay.
Hmm. Well, that was Holmes, I'm almost sure.
Hmm.
Yeah, and Peter took over later. He knew how tight it was. That was a very facile thing he had to say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just walked rings around the members. I mean, he would say things like that. Oh, well, okay. that was facile.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that degree of money growth was restricted, but the reason was because of the big price shock, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
There's some truth to that, isn't it?
Sure. Sure.
That was another time on the directive. We tried and finally just gave up. And maybe this is a time when your expectations are so important. To try to get him to distinguish between a once and for all level adjustment and an adjustment in the rate of growth. Of saying, look, there was this big oil shock,
mm-hmm.
big price shock. It's very hard on the economy to try to adjust to that with the constant quantity of money.
Mm-hmm.
And you simply tell people, you're doing this once and for all increase to adjust for this, but that you won't give in to inflation and you go back to the same old growth rate, then you'll take a lot of the pressure off the economy, which is in essence what the Japanese did. And he wouldn't listen because he said, you know, people won't know the difference. They'll think we're underwriting inflation, blah, blah, blah. Maybe he was right. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, you know, he was willing to think in terms of money growth and its implications when it fit his purpose.
Yeah.
We love this. I mean, no, I mean, you might think, you know, in the confines of his office, it was all doing Burns and Mitchell. No, we talked money growth. I mean, it was pretty modern stuff.
Hmm. So, he, at least publicly, he was, or I don't know, semi privately to our principals, he was always scathing whenever he talked about Keynesian models or monetarist models. That's just because he didn't want to be tied down by any particular...
That's right. That's one thing, mate. When I started making FOMC presentations, I was so naive. I couldn't figure out. The other guys, Partee and Gramley and these guys, always talked about the past. And I got to do the fun part, which was do the forecast, the model simulations. And I thought, God, why did they let me have that neat stuff? Well, it didn't take me long to find out why. I mean, birds would just pound on me mercilessly, right?
So these would be Monday morning...
Or even chart show stuff, FOMC things, that's right. And the, you know, he would use a model really as a thing to criticize.
But
which caused a lot of the problems, see, because he wanted it in his pristine form so he could show how silly it was.
Yeah, I
didn't want it tying his hands. And it was always my job to say, no, you don't use it that way. You try a little common sense.
Mm-hmm.
And just smile at them.
So what you're saying is that, as I'm trying to understand the model that Burns carried around in his head about the economy, it was partly Mitchell, but he had absorbed elements of the Keynesian model and the monetarist model. So he was... much more up to date.
The only real lacking that we found when he first came is he didn't have a foggiest idea about the mechanics of central banking. And so we had, it is understandable, but I had some sort of funny meetings where you kept getting the sign wrong on purchases and sales and stuff like that.
That's interesting because, because people associate Arthur Burns with central banking, so they just
assume. But he wasn't. He didn't come from that at all.
And his research was never on the financial side.
No. There were some really remarkable gaping holes.
So he knew.
It was just sort of fun to watch. I mean, the man was, he was very quick study, and got so he understood it.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly didn't come with that expertise at all. The unemployment rate month by month from 1066, but he didn't know anything about monetary policy.
Was that ultimately part of the problem, or the problem was rather that you said he simply misjudged the...
I think he misjudged. I think he got...
trade-off.
But he didn't jump right in and try to bull... He was no bull in a china shop, so he went pretty easy to begin with until he understood... And he learned that he could, on the technical stuff, that he really could trust the staff, that no one was going to do him in.
Mm-hmm.
That there would be a straight discussion of, that no one would ever tell him to move in the wrong direction and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't think so. I think he misjudged.
And he had this personality where he needed to dominate, and presumably that carried over to the feeling that, he was just intelligent enough to kind of dominate on a wide scale, both within the political system and within the economy.
Right.
And that personality must have been part...
I think that was part of it. I never really totally understood the man, but I think there's a lot of truth to that. He ended up... for all his presence in Washington, of not being a very successful central banker. In my opinion, I mean, compare him to Greenspan. Greenspan's done a fine job.
Sure. Yeah, ultimately he was pretty much of a disaster.
Right.
Sure.
But, but he certainly was a much more of a commanding presence than Greenspan.
Yeah. What was he like as an individual? I come from a regional bank, and so, I get the stories of how during FOMC meetings and apart from FOMC meetings, he was just merciless with individuals who were willing to oppose him, poor Al Hayes, whom he just sat on continually, and Daryl Francis from St. Louis. But was that just kind of engineered to just...
Well, part of it. I mean, if he hadn't had Daryl Francis, he would have invented him. I mean, Daryl was this broken record. And because he was, you knew exactly what he was going to say. Mm-hmm. He was just a wonderful foil for Burns, so Burns used him. And so, you know, I don't think he had a hatred. I mean, I think he would have missed him because he was so handy. I think Hayes was more complicated. I think that's more of the New York mystique and showing who's boss.
Mm-hmm.
And that also explains, you know, requiring the manager of the market account to be in Washington every day when you're picking on him. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Reminding him who he works for, because he technically, you know, when he's doing that, he's an employee of the FOMC and not the New York Fed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a real nuance, but I mean, he was trying to make that point. He didn't like people to go against him. And unlike Martin, I mean, Martin did it with just elegance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember meetings where he wouldn't say a word, and then he'd summarize the meeting, and his summary had nothing whatsoever to do with anything anybody had ever said.
Yeah.
So remarkable, but Eric was sort of too polite to point it out, and so he just summarized what he wanted to do, and then they go do it.
Yeah, and I've read the minutes, and there were some meetings where there were just, like, before this reduction in interest rates in the summer of 1968, and I mean, you read the minutes, and you got to say that you know, these divergences are very sharp. And then he would start a summary and say, "Well, we're really not very far apart today."
I know.
And you know, let's combine. So you know, the committee seems to want A, and I had initially wanted B. So let's combine these two. And then he would write a fuzzy directive and get what he wanted. And nobody would. Because the guy was such a great guy, nobody would.
No, that's right.
Challenge him.
That's right. And so he got his influence in just almost a diametrically opposed way from Burns. Burns would run roughshod over people. Most of them he was smarter than. He's had much more knowledge of it. He knew more detail. I mean, he'd even shoot the staff down sometimes on these little nitty points, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I have to say, well, good for you, you know, dumbass fact. Anyway, mm-hmm. And he was pretty rough.
Mm-hmm.
Yet he somehow, for all his roughness, managed to get the FOMC to think it did more than it was doing. And let me try to explain. I have a story I like to tell people about. One time, I used to be on all these committees, the Blue Book Committee and the Green Book and all that stuff. And one time, there were always three alternatives. And the one they were supposed to vote on was B. And B was the thing that Burns wanted them to do. So he'd get together with Axelrod and he'd tell Axelrod what he wanted. And then we were supposed to come up with stuff that matched that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of interest rates or whatever it is. Usually interest rates. One time, for some reason or other, he had some agenda and he wanted to have four alternatives. And we started joking and giggling, how they'll know what to vote for, because they're always supposed to vote for B. And so I thought we could have signs, this time vote for B prime. I think we ended up calling it B prime or something like that. In other words, it was all sort of a sham.
Mm-hmm.
The decisions were made ahead of time.
Yeah, that's what our principal said, that they had the feeling that Burns came into the meetings already knowing what he wanted.
There's no question. He knew. And those somehow they thought these numbers came out of, I don't know where they thought these numbers came from, the Blue Book numbers and so on. Those were negotiated with Burns. And so the real policy was the staff trying to negotiate with Burns, saying, you don't know, you can't do that. You can't have those rates that low and that money growth. And so we go back and forth, and finally we get the best B we could. I mean, it was really crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest was just sort of show.
The idea of the Blue Book was to, I mean, after the fact, after 67, 68, the committee said, well, gee, we got more money growth than we wanted. If we had known how much money growth we were going to get at those level of interest rates, we would have been more adventuresome in changing interest rates. So the idea of the green of the Blue Book initially was to associate the interest rate target with projections for money so people wouldn't be surprised. Then the idea was that, well, if you knew what was coming, then you'd take care of it. But then you got into this kind of menu thing where the alternative interest rates were really associated with kind of near-term projections of money growth, a lot of which was seasonal. And then the committee would choose a projection, the committee would choose an alternative depending upon what it wanted interest rates to do. That is, if money growth was projected to be 7%, really wanted interest rates to go up, but it wasn't quite, didn't quite have the confidence to go with it, then it would come up with a two-month target range for money that would be 5% instead of the 7%, and then, you know, with the assumption that, well, it'll
right, but no change on the interest rate, so that
right.
You know where you get it. Right.
Right.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing with the models, unending frustration. We had this monthly model just trying to get some structure into the money interest rate relationship. And the first thing we would do when we meet with Axelrod is we'd simply double the multipliers. He'd double them every time. And he's usually more than double them, so he can negotiate it back to doubling them.
Okay, go over that again.
If the model said that in order to slow money growth by 0.5%,
mm-hmm.
you had to raise interest rates by 1%,
mm-hmm.
Axelrod would always conclude it only took 0.5% or a quarter. And we'd have these gigantic wars.
Because he thought Burns would
be. He's not thought, he knew. I mean, he came in already with what the interest rate was going to be.
Burns was really a...
Burns was setting interest rates.
Despite his bravado, he was really extremely cautious about interest rates. I mean,
he didn't care. That's right, it was interest rates.
He was the old line school that if you change an interest rate by a big amount, that was a source of instability.
Well, not careful itself. Now. He was perfectly willing to change them a lot in 74. He didn't want to change them a lot when they would get in the way of a very expansionary monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
Thing wasn't symmetric.
Mm-hmm. Well, the committee was moving in the direction of reserve control, wasn't it?
Subject to an interest rate constraint, sure.
Right, but it was Burns who, in early 72, when the committee thought it was actually going to be targeting a reserve path, it was Burns that came up with these very binding interest rate, funds rate.
That's right. Well, and some meaningless reserve numbers that I can't remember what they were anymore.
Reserves available to support.
Yeah, that
deposits.
Thing. Nobody even knew what they were. We had to go find Holland, ask him what in the hell it was. nobody knew. But it didn't make any difference because there was a binding interest rate constraint. So it didn't make any difference.
Yeah.
He was just always wrong every time.
Did you find him? When he argued, people argue for different reasons. They argue, some people argue because they think it's fun. They think they like to win. There are other people who argue that they really have to win. They become angry if they feel like they're losing.
He was always very courteous with me.
Mm-hmm. So he wasn't the kind of person. He wasn't privately somebody who would lose his temper or be a bully, or he was always in control and in his personal relationships he was courteous with other people.
Sure. Oh yeah, no, he was very, that's right. I always had the I always just had the feeling, whenever he was arguing, he was practicing.
Mm-hmm.
That it really wasn't someone with strongly held views, but who would be willing to change them if you could convince him.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, he wanted to hear, he never said this, but this was just always the impression I got. He wanted to hear the toughest arguments he could.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he'd have an answer ready. It was not a matter of striving, questing for truth and light.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of fun, but...
Yeah. Hmm.
A very smart man.
So, you ultimately left the board primarily because it was just attractive, you had an attractive offer in Berkeley?
No, I couldn't stand anymore.
Just the general...
The beating of inflation, I finally decided no matter how high up I got and what I did, it wasn't going to change. And I just thought monetary policy was terrible. So I decided to leave before I knew where I was going.
So when was that?
I left in 75. I decided to leave. I told him I'm leaving. Where are you going? I don't know. I'm leaving. and it was non-negotiable. And then I started sort of looking around. And then I got this offer to go on the Hill for a year with Henry Royce, and just for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said I'd do it. And that was really a year, well, sort of fun years anyway, but it gave me time to decide what I was going to do. I knew I was going back to academics. The only question is, where?
Mm-hmm. So your objection was with the decision-making process, or you simply thought that you were wasting a lot of time trying to influence a policy that was not likely to be very well informed?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I, for years, thought that we get sort of modern economics to bear on monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
That the arguments would be sufficiently compelling that they went out. And that the problem was that the most senior staff was not technically very good and felt threatened by more modern economics. And that somehow one could get high enough, one could overcome that. And it was finally this realization that wasn't true, that that really wasn't where the problem lay. That it was people, Burns in particular, thinking he knew what it was right and just doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was political. And the rest, and the other part was just the constant rankling of having somehow to listen to the criticism because I knew some economics by the staff. I found that. It just never ceased to send me up the wall. That I was a technician.
That criticism came from?
Everybody.
From the staff?
Yes. Any one of them.
So it was kind of the attitude of people like Axelrod?
Absolutely. Granly. Real. First, not real. Dan was okay. Partee, yeah. I was this technician.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets to you.
Yeah, the kind of condescension that, well, you don't have enough political reality of the situation.
That's right. Here I am. I may not know any economics, but boy, I sure know how the world works because I'm such a sensible person.
And I appreciate how significant housing is to the
right.
political sector, and that means there are just some things you can't do even if...
Right. And you know, and I'm willing to say, look, we just use a model that helps us think.
Mm-hmm.
that no blind use of the thing. And it just got, you know, it just was just a constant irritation to me. And just a war. It was always a war to have the people with the technical backgrounds, you know, sort of modern economics, have them be listened to. That they were never given the same credence as somebody who happened to know what happened in the S&L industry week before last. So I always had to just battle.
I'm kind of coming to this in a minute. Let me finish up.
Now, people like Tinsley and so on. You know, Peter's just brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's kind of... I don't know quite what the word is, sad. You have very competent people. They make a decision, you know, I want to go to all the FOMC meetings and do the board briefings and kind of work my way up and become the member of a team, or I want to retain my objectivity. And the latter group, Dick Porter comes to mind. There are others. They tend to get kind of put out to pasture. And
by some standard, I was very successful, right? I was doing all this stuff.
Well, but ultimately, I think that most people, your case is probably atypical, and yourself would not
remain
at the center of the decision making. You know, Peter Tinsley and Dick Porter would go off to one side and have a significant title. And in 76, when you were working for Henry Royce, were you involved in the negotiations with the Fed over, was initially House Concurrent Resolution 133? I mean, Bob Weintraub had the idea that
You got your dates off. That was before I left. I think H. Conrad was 1974 or 1975. Back then.
So that was before you left.
Right.
So then you were really involved in housing things, and you weren't so much involved in.
Well, I refused to. I mean, Burns was. He got pretty paranoid about me. But my agreement with Rice was that I would not do monetary policy. Mm-hmm. And I surely wasn't going to tell any secrets. And that I just didn't want anything to do with that. I was working on financial reform, mm-hmm. things like that. I studiously avoided what was going on. There was a lot of negotiation going on with Burns about testifying and giving real income targets and so on.
Well, Humphrey Hawkins became involved.
Right, and I just stayed out of it. He never believed that, but I did.
How did Burns feel about things like Regulation Q?
He liked it. He was, I'm telling you, the man, Milton Friedman, he was not.
Well, that's one of the strangest stories of all times, how Milton Friedman could deceive himself into thinking that Burns saw the world the same way he did.
Because apparently they both are politically conservative, but Burns isn't conservative. It was not conservative in any sense. He liked Reg Q. He wanted, I remember one of the great staff triumphs was to get him to take reserve requirements off of big CDs. I mean, that was a war. And even then, he insisted on having standby authority. He liked it because it gave him another lever. And he liked to intervene.
He did take, during the Penn Square...
That's right. That's when it came off.
May of 1970. What came off was right. Reg Q, not...
That's right. It had to come off. Mm-hmm. It took a panic, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you said reserve requirements. You meant the Reg Q.
Reg Q, I'm sorry.
Remember
what we got. Now it's coming back. To get the big CDs off, was Martin. He had standby authority to do marginal reserve requirements.
I see.
And that seemed like, now I remember, that sounded like not a bad horse trade with him.
I see. So he subsequently took credit for that, but in fact it was a staff idea.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had to offer him something in return. And we dreamed that one. I remember that now. We dreamed that one up. At least it got him on a margin. See, sometimes analytics help. I told him, explained to him, that was at least around a margin, you know, in a damn corner.
Yeah. Did you have the feeling at any time during this period that... Burns felt that Fed independence was threatened by Congress, so that he was pushed? Or was he always kind of basically doing what he did because that's what he wanted to do?
He put all that argument out when it fit his purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I never had the impression in private discussion he thought it was any important threat. I mean, he had to huff and puff about it and fight Congress, you know, sort of a ritual he had. But he certainly would argue that when it fit his purpose. But I never had the impression he thought it was anything that was very likely to occur. Mm-hmm. Knew how important it was. He understood the politics of things very well. Mm-hmm. example, he got really, when I left him, he got really mad at me for proposing that Reserve Bank presidents be appointed rather than, and reduce the power of boards of directors of Reserve Banks.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew why he did that.
Sure.
He got really mad. I mean, it gets political, tremendous political.
Well, the directors can walk right into the office of a congressman. At least our directors are almost all pretty well-off individuals, and they know their congressman on first-name basis.
Absolutely, and so it gives this constituency. I mean, I understand why the Federal Reserve has it.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems, I don't think it's good public policy to be set up that way.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he fully understood why Reserve Bank directors were important. He understood all that. He had got that part of politics just right. You never had to explain any of that stuff to him.
Yeah.
He had that one down cold. And so he never wanted anything to erode that influence. And I suppose, you know, as the chairman of the Federal Reserve, that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Did he think that it was an imminent thing to lose it? No. I don't think so. Congress, you know, all they do is huff and puff.
Well, what did somebody like Henry Royce think of Burns? Was Royce like Patman, where he was happy to make a lot of noise, but ultimately wasn't really willing to clip the Fed's wings? Or?
Well, I think Henry was willing. He didn't know how to do it, and he didn't have the political. I think probably Patman was, too.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of them had the political clout to be able to accomplish much. It's very difficult to go up against the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
And it just isn't something you can rally members of Congress around. Mm-hmm. And both Patman mm-hmm. and Royce were not remarkably adept politicians. Unlike, say, St. Germain, who was a good politician. For all his other faults, he was a good politician.
Mm-hmm.
Royce had sort of grandiose ideas, and he just thought somehow, because he was smart and he knew the right answer, everyone would just go along, and then sort of surprised when it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any contact with Proxmire?
Some. Mm-hmm. Not much, but some.
How did he think? He attacked the Fed when it served his purpose?
Proxmire, all those guys, he was much more a political animal than he got. His golden fleece did him no end of good.
Mm-hmm.
He was a, you know, he was a political animal.
Yeah.
I could never really tell how he was any different from the rest of them.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, getting political capital, but knowing full well nothing was going to happen.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you some kind of particular questions, kind of ostensibly the reason I called you. About how the Green Book forecast got made when you were at the board. Now, in principle, if you, as an economist, the way you think about making a forecast is, well, you've got to have an objective function in which the monetary authority is specifies its goals for inflation and unemployment, and then you know, if you're in the Fed, well, then you make some assumption about fiscal policy, some assumption about the foreign sector, and then solve the model on the basis of whatever you think exogenous is going on in the economy, and out of that falls an interest rate path. Now, obviously it's not done that. The Green Book forecasts aren't done that way. They still aren't done that way. But if you think about how they get made, I mean, in some sense, you've got to make a forecast. You have to start with an objective for monetary policy, don't you?
I don't know how they're done now.
Yeah, I can tell you that, and that might be interesting because then you might say, oh, yeah, it's the same or it's a lot different.
All right, but let me tell you, because a little bit of how they originally were done, and they got modified a little bit, but not very much.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started going to Green Book meetings, I was this young person, mm-hmm. and I was really puzzled, and I asked someone, I said, well, what are you assuming about monetary policy? And I just got this blank look. There was no monetary policy assumption. These so-called judgmental forecasters simply, I think what they, all they do is really just do a first difference. And the past isn't going to be very much different from the... I mean, the future's not going to be very much different from the past, right? So you just assume everything grows by 0.25% or whatever it is you're going to assume, and you keep trying to keep the sector sort of in balance. And the real sector, all the real forecasts was made independent of any monetary or financial thing at all. And then later on, the financial detail would get added in to sort of be consistent with it. Now, I know you probably don't believe it, but it was true.
So you can make forecasts for a quarter or so, but how far out would
they didn't go
that?
Out very far.
Uh-huh.
They would only go out like 6 months, sometimes a year.
Mm-hmm.
We never could get them, I think, to go out farther than a year.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, well, again, that time Burns got furious at me. I tried to go out a year and a half. Man, he had a fit. I thought you go out far enough that what you're doing now might have a difference, right?
If you go out far enough, you have to make some assumptions about policy.
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it. That's right.
Yeah.
See, these are so short term. How far do they go out now? A year or more?
Well, I think once a year the staff has to do it out like six quarters, but not.
That's the max, right? And then
yeah.
It gets shorter.
Yeah, it's about
a year and a half.
Usually it's about a year.
Well, there's an awful lot of initial conditions, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can sort of get halfway there without doing any economics at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's basically what these guys did. They were really expert about what was going on in their sector.
Mm-hmm.
Knew a lot. I mean, business, what they used to call business economists, or we call judgmental economists, you know, just stare at the wall and figure out what's going to happen. And that's how the Blue Book forecasts were made. Then totally separate from it.
You mean the Green Book forecast?
The Green Book, I'm sorry. Then totally separate from that, the Blue Book was done, and there was nothing initially, in no connection at all, which also sort of puzzled me. Anyway, don't the interest rates depend upon what's going on in the economy?
Yeah.
It got a little better, and one role the model did do, or models, did do was to force a discipline where it just became increasingly difficult for people to make a forecast, because we'd always say, well, what do you assume about monetary policy? And they had to start thinking about it, and a better job was done of getting the two a little bit better integrated, but never very much.
So the forecasting exercise would not start with an assumption about the interest rate path?
No. No, well, no.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Okay.
Until very late in the day, Lyle Gramley, who ran these, had two groups. He had his judgmental guys, Court Parade, and these people, I remember them dearly, doing their forecasts. Then the model guys. We'd come in and we'd compare. And I'd say, well, how are we going to compare till I know what in the hell you're assuming about monetary policy? He'd always give us a monetary policy assumption. I told him, I said, we got to have one, for Christ's sake. We can't just... It's meaningless, you know, it's empty. We can't solve this thing. I got too many questions. See, and so we get one. And then our model would be different. And I said, well, you're asking us to do a monetary policy that isn't going to happen. You're going to say, here, money's been growing at 8% a year or whatever it was, and suddenly you're assuming it's only going to grow at 4. Our model says the following. Your judgmental guys aren't restricted like that. They know all along it's going to continue to grow. And so they took that into account. So you're doing apples and oranges here.
Yeah.
Well, he said, well, they don't know how to do the other one. I said, well, that's meaningful. And so we'd have these gigantic fights. I don't know how it's done now. I bet it isn't all that different.
It looks exactly the same. When you look at the page, it's got the same format. The numbers are the same, and the stories are all the same. The Green Book is just stories. There's no...
And
there's no... you look at these numbers, and there's no sense whatsoever of how a internal consistency is imposed and how you arrive at an aggregate figures that make macroeconomic sense. That just that's never explained, and as far as I know, the staff has never written it down or explained it. I think what they do now is Mike Prell makes some assumption about what inflation rate they want to have a year from now, and he's implicitly got an objective for unemployment, because that inflation objective is never very much different from the current one.
Uh-huh.
And then he will take the interest rate path that was done last period, just whatever it was, and then he'll consider incoming information since the last meeting. Did the statistics come in strong? And he'll also see what the yield curve did. Does the market expect the Fed to tighten? Did the slope of the yield curve move up because payroll unemployment came in at 350,000 and so on? Then he'll adjust the last period interest rate path in this ongoing way. Then he'll give that interest rate path to the judgmental guys who are doing the interest sensitive real sectors,
and like housing and stuff like that,
housing,
right?
Business, fixed investment, and so on.
Uh-huh.
And then he'll come up with four or five of these interest sector sensitive components. He'll put those together and get a rough figure for the rate of growth of real output. And then they've got a productivity equation which translates into an unemployment rate, and then they've got a formula that they use, which is that if the unemployment rate is above the NARU by 2 percentage points for 1 year, that'll cause a 1 percentage point change in the inflation rate. And they use that formula to come up with the figure for inflation. And if that's close to what Prell wants as an outcome, then you know they go on. If not, then they'll iterate back and forth, and they'll talk to him, and he'll say, well, maybe we ought to have a little more of an increase in interest rates here or whatever, and they'll go through the process again until they come up with this inflation number that looks kind of like it's what they want. And when they've done that, then they've got a kind of a rough figure for real GDP growth and for inflation, and then they got some guy with this huge table where he puts these figures in. People come in with their individual sectoral forecasts, and as they put these in, they jiggle them, tinker with them until they get certain ratios to look reasonable,
Christ.
Like the savings ratio. And then everything looks consistent.
Uh-huh.
And then they put it, and that's basically the Green Book forecast out for several quarters. Then they will send that over to the model people along with the interest rate path, and they'll say, tinker with the intercept terms on your equations until you replicate the initial couple quarters, and then tell us what the next several quarters are going to look like.
Oh, Christ. So nothing's happened. Okay. That's exactly the way it was.
Oh.
You have, what you described, that's a much more orderly description of what used to happen. It's just the same.
Okay. And I...
Except, I used to at least go to the Green Book meetings and would throw in my 2 bits worth all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know whether many model people do now or not.
Well, I talked to Clint Brayton. I actually had a very congenial discussion with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was somebody I could talk to. And then I tried to talk to some of the judgmental people. I'm going to talk to some more of them. It was much more harder to talk to them. There was always a sense of exasperation in their voice. Like, why are you asking this? This is so obvious what we're,
right.
what we're doing. Everybody should know this. They couldn't anyways. But it was kind of funny because they really don't know what the model people are doing, and the model people really don't know what the judgmental.
It's worse than. See, I used to refuse to do them separately, mm-hmm. and it was sort of partly that's sort of one of my jobs. I was supposed to straddle the model and the other ones, you know, and also the Blue Book, Green Book, and Saudis refused to do that, so it's even worse than it used to be. There's no VAR or anything like that?
No, and if you know, I asked the question of the judgmental while I talked to Larry Sliffman, and I said, well, how do you pose, is there any meaningful sense in which you impose economic theory on your forecast? And he says, oh, sure, people in the individual sectors have their equations. So whoever's doing, I don't know, business fixed investment,
right. So they'll
car
have
sales,
or
whatever,
thing,
they'll have an OLS regression equation that they use and that they tinker with period by period, and they've each got those. I didn't even want to say that. Well, you know, a lot of OLS regression equations does not a model make. Nothing's identified. That seemed to be a comment that would have been totally out of order. So they feel like that they have so that they have certain guidelines that they use. In particular, this what I just described to you, what they call the 2-to-1 sacrifice ratio, that seems to be enshrined. But other kind of guidelines, if you ask them about, like if you ask them what change in the real rate of interest would you need to eliminate or change the rate of growth of real output by 1 percentage point, or how much on average does the real rate of interest rise over a cycle? There's none of that. You know, they have certain rules of thumb, but other rules of thumb which touch on interest rates they aren't willing to specify. Well, anyway, so this gets it's a little bit. It gets back to the original form of the forecast, because then when the forecasts are made, the interest rate path is totally expunged. It appears nowhere, and you can infer the objective for inflation when you get these six-quarter forecasts. Because
so you're
you
saying
can
they
see
work
what
backwards.
That is.
In some sense, this is what's going to be presented to Congress.
Well, the Green Book isn't made public.
Well,
except,
but it's got to be consistent,
that,
right?
Except that the Treasury gets a copy.
Sure, I can't imagine
that
when they coincide, that the Green Book's six-quarter out is going to be different from what's presented to Congress, right?
Well, yeah, the Humphrey Hawkins forecasts, which are odd in themselves, in that the individual members first have to forecast what other individual members are going to do as far as monetary policy goes, then they can make their own forecast.
Right.
Rather than get together,
sure,
come to some kind of consensus about
what
they're going to do, and then make their forecast on the basis of that common consensus. But we've been in the situation before where they rejected one of our forecasts because they didn't think it was appropriate. So they are sensitive to getting something that on average looks like what they're saying, but they call it a forecast.
No, I understand.
They
understand. Right. This is coming back to me. See, I've been away from this for so long, I forget all this.
But there's no... But it's...
Sure. Okay.
But when you finish...
That's really remarkable.
When you finish with these forecasts, there's no interest rate path. So there's no assumption.
Yeah, right.
And there's no objective visible, so that you... you expunge all evidence on the preferences of policymakers in these forecasts, even though it's an internal forecast. So, you know, the question is, how do you use that as a basis for discussion, since you can't argue about the results that you're getting on the basis of, you know, kind of one's view of theory. You can't say, well, you know, the permanent income hypothesis would suggest that consumption really ought to be higher or whatever, because there is no, you know, theory doesn't impose consistency on it. So it doesn't serve as a basis for for discussion among economists.
I mean, that's, okay. Things haven't changed.
Yeah.
And I guess if you were designing something that would give the board and the chairman in particular the most, well, that's what you design.
Yeah, so that the only discussion at FOMC meetings concerns policy actions rather than a strategy. And the chairman, if he doesn't get the policy action he wants this meeting, well, he'll get it next meeting, or, you know, it's always easy to postpone.
And so that's the way I think it's always been.
Yeah.
And it's just remarkable. I would have thought that at least they were doing VARs and things like that, right, that are sort of neutral and you can't, there's no politics in them or anything like that. At least you're picking up regularities in the data, right?
Yeah.
Really
yeah.
Fancy modern-day Burns and Mitchell, if you will.
Yeah, but no, absolutely. There's no... and there's no longer any model. Well, there is a sense there's a model forecast twice a year in the they go through this exercise in the Blue Book, and as far as I can tell, this is really the only way the model is used in a significant way. In the February and July meeting Blue Books, they'll go through this process, and then they'll calibrate the model to replicate the initial judgmental forecast, and they'll then use the model to make a forecast for several years. And then what they'll do is they'll assume that the funds rate is initially a quarter of a percentage point higher or a quarter of a percentage point lower. They'll have some different path for the funds rate, and then they'll make a forecast that then will yield a different path for inflation, and then they'll put those in the Blue Book, and they'll say, "Okay, these are long-range scenarios, and in principle, you can choose which inflation rate you want, and then that gives you a different
based on different funds rate."
Yeah, then that'll have different implications for the funds rate, but that's
there's almost none for today's funds rate because you can
sure
right
sure. And
that's the same game we used to play with money growth. You got far enough to make a partial difference what you're doing right now.
And it,
sure, okay.
But even that's not discussed at FOMC meetings. It's their kind of pro forma, but and I'm not sure quite why it is there. Maybe
it may actually, isn't that remarkable? It may actually be less analytical than it used to be. That's truly remarkable.
Well, I get the feeling that the model people really don't have much to do that, in the sense that
well, unless I'd use the word model, I would just say analytical people, right?
Well, yeah, that's the,
I mean,
yeah, that's
no
the,
one believes
yeah.
in models the way they used to.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, if you're analytical, you choose your own
right
model.
I mean, you don't,
in this case it's a,
we all learned the hard way that these models don't work very well, and you know, they're subject to Lucas critique and all these sorts of things that.
Sure, but ultimately they're a way of thinking that
absolutely
forces
they help you.
You
need some structure. Lucas never argued that you didn't go out and look, stare at the ceiling.
That's right. Well, that's one thing James Tobin and Bob Lucas and Milton Friedman that they all agree on. I mean, you work off a model one way or the other, and you're kidding yourself.
You got to be analytical.
You're kidding yourself.
You need some structure, right? That's really depressing. But you know what's sort of interesting? Monetary policy's been pretty good.
Yeah, I think it's been pretty good because the Fed really got burned in the 70s on inflation.
Yeah.
And people were saying, why do you need an independent central bank if you're going to be getting
10%? All you want to do is get all the votes for Nixon, right? That's right. So,
inflation.
No, I think that's
so,
right.
Volcker,
and they've been lucky, too. I mean, there have been no shocks. So all the shocks that have occurred have been in the right direction.
But Volcker and Greenspan were both individuals who came up through this period, and they kind of feel it deep
right.
down inside that they know what kind
Avoid,
of social
right.
turmoil, how mm-hmm. divisive it was to set off that inflation, and they were both of them were determined it wasn't going to happen again. Now, what happens 10 years from now or 20 years from now, when you get a whole new generation of people, I don't know whether these are lessons that are, you know, just kind of learned.
They'll see pretty soon, I think. You're already starting to hear, they sound so familiar to me. You know, the economy's still expanding. People are saying, well, there's no inflation. See, the world's different now. We don't get inflation anymore because there's international competition, blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
And I remember back, boy, I sure heard those arguments before. It takes a long time to get that baby gone. But it sure does. It takes a long time to get it stopped. We'll see pretty soon now, I think.